The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It's June. Unemployment rate at a 16-year low. Financial stocks feeling the rate pressure. 10-year yield sub 220 and a bunch of listener questions. All this and much more on episode number 512 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, good day. Andrew Horowitz is here with you, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. And after a few weekends out of town, I'm back here in Fort Lauderdale. Hopefully you had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend, a short week for markets. And now we're back to work for everybody, it seems. Well, at least the summertime version. I remember, you know, back when I lived up in New York, and there was this kind of, four-day week feeling all the time. Do you have that when you're where you work and where you live? Where on Fridays it was like, all right, well, half-day Fridays, summer Fridays. It's all the time that people would be talking about this and kind of took some of the time off. It's not the same in Florida, and I wonder if it's because of the lack of seasons and the seasonality where it's just warm and oftentimes rather nice throughout the year, so we don't feel rushed to actually go out and do whatever those summertime activities may be. But anyway, hopefully you had the opportunity to listen to last week's show. We had Frank Curzio on. And he has some great nuggets of info and ideas that he discussed, some stocks, some of his favorite stock picks for 2017. I'll actually be on his show this week, so make sure to listen in to his show, which is Wall Street Unplugged. You can go over to frankcurzio.com and get that and check that out. And I'll put some links up and I'll tweet it, etc. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Andrew Horowitz, by the way, one word. So make sure to do that. Let me give you a couple of updates on a few things before we get into the meat of the show. And I'll give you an update on Investology because I'm getting a lot of emails on that and tell you what's going on. So we have, as I think you remember, we had been working on a beta test. I want to make sure that the front end and the back end of the system and the site and the information is all ready to go in a way that is really user-friendly, understandable, because that's the whole point of this, to have a user-friendly and easily accessible type of investment platform. As I mentioned, we took some of the greatest, I think, ideas from robo-investing, which this is not traditional robo-investing, but we took some of the ideas from that in terms of the technology and then integrated that with what we're doing here, which is these advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced portfolio management processes, and we've completed the first stage of the beta test. And now, well, we're on to the second and final stage of that. So thanks for all that are participating in this. I really appreciate all your efforts. We will be announcing when this is successfully completed and when it will be opening for everybody to take a look at and to invest in. So it's looking good. I'm pretty happy about that. Well, let's take a look at some of the economic headlines for the week. And clearly, employment was in focus over the week. We saw that the ADP numbers came out on Thursday. Usually, they come out on Wednesday, but it was a short week, so they did come out on Thursday. Estimates were for about 170,000. The actual number came in at a whopping 255,000 new additions to payrolls, according to ADP. And what was really interesting about that is that, you know, it was a big surprise. I mean, still at 170 or 200,000, that's a good number on ADP. But 255, wow. Everybody was very excited about what was going to happen towards the end of the week. The next day when the non-farm payrolls came out and the official employment numbers came out. And then we did see that on Friday there was somewhat of a disappointment. Expectations were for a jump to or about the 174,000 additions or so We saw that this has been a consistent level that has been seen over the last several months. And there was no real, there was really no thought on, well, this should be a lot lower or a lot higher, even though we did see that the ADP numbers were good. So there was really going into this number, a high level of confidence that we'll see a decent number in terms of the non-farm payrolls number. Well, on Friday, the number came out at 138. Now, that was met with some mixed reviews. What was also interesting was that we dropped from a 4.4% unemployment rate down to a 4.3% unemployment rate, the lowest rate in, I think, 16 years. Now, private payrolls came in at 147,000 versus expectations of 172. Unemployment rate, again, hit this 4.3%. What was interesting also, and I thought that was kind of something concerning, not too concerning, but at least somewhat of an eye raiser, was that we did see that the numbers from the previous month, from April, were revised down. So the payroll number of 211,000 new adds in April was revised down to 174. So it was, again, a mixed bag, because the headline number for unemployment was better than expected, but somehow the hiring has slowed down a little bit. I'm not sure if that's something that's going to be playing out in the same way over the next several months. Right now, it still does appear that for the most part, employers are actively adding new hires. The economy, generally speaking, is doing well. There's little pockets of issues here and there, but nothing substantial. We did see the average work week staying the same and the average hourly earnings coming in with a change of 0.2%, which is lower than the expected, I believe it was 0.3%. So markets, what happened? Well, markets were at first somewhat surprised by the number, the low new additions to the payrolls. Markets dipped down. And as markets have been doing for some time now, it's a momentary, transitory type of situation, thinking that, okay, things are okay. The markets really haven't had a lot of volatility. Well, you know what? We're going to start buying into it. And by the end of the day, the markets were all up across the board. As a matter of fact, the small caps jumped dramatically, both on Friday and on Thursday. I think almost 3%. Almost 3% gain in 2 days last week for the small caps, which have been lagging dramatically. And we did also see, which was interesting and probably, I would say, appropriate, that the 10-year yield, the yield on the 10-year treasury, dipped to 2.16%. Now, this is with a backdrop of the Fed saying that they are going to be raising rates and they see the economy doing better. Now, in their last Fed minutes, they talked about how things have been, well, a little bit slower than anticipated, but nothing to worry about. And for the most part, most Fed officials have been still continuing the discussion that there'll be two rate hikes throughout 2017. Now, how about currencies? What happened there? Well, the U.S. dollar dropped below a key technical level, sitting at about 96.67 at the end of the week. And I marked this level. So on my charts, I mark a level of importance from back to just when the November election happened. And the level there was 96.85. So we're right now trading at 96.67. And then if you remember, after the election, the dollar rocketed. I mean, just moved incredibly, with the idea that, well, we're going to see tax reform, we're going to see regulations that are going to be lessened, all these really good things that would be very beneficial to the U.S. economy. The U.S. dollar moved all the way to about 103. There was this great hope trade going on that things are going to get stronger fast. I mean, like immediately, this is going to happen tomorrow. And the U.S. dollar was really moving considerably. But when we look at it now, that whole entire move up, that breakout to 103 has been entirely reversed, to a point where essentially you have to wonder, is the thought that much of the reform that was going to go on delayed for extremely long period of time into the future. Is it going to happen in 2018? Everybody thought, well, there'll be something done in 2017. Yeah, maybe we'll get the taxes. That's easy. We'll get the corporate tax reduction in 2017 that they're talking about. And maybe we'll get at least less regulations. Or let's put it this way, no more further onerous regulations on, on companies. So maybe, maybe it's going to be a situation where we're going to at least have opportunity. And again, the dollar was doing very well, but now it just seems like there's a pause. There's a question mark. People are wondering how much can actually get done at where we are now at 2017. Now we're in June. You got the August break coming up, I believe, in for Congress, and really nothing's going to get done before there. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said he wanted the tax reform done before that. Then he came back and revised and said, I don't think it can get done before that. So if you don't get it done before August, September, probably you're not going to get any of the tax reductions retroactively for 2017. Therefore, we're moving it to 2018. So maybe we'll get that opportunity for the taxes to be implemented somewhere in 2018. So that's still good. There's still that carrot, out there, and pricing of earnings and PE ratios and the stock market that are consistent with that, continuing on. But again, the one thing that I'll tell you about this is that the 10-year, going back to that at 216, did reflect pretty well what was seen in the unemployment report. Currencies, the dollar, reflected well with what happened with the unemployment report. Gold reflected very well what happened with the unemployment report. It went straight up. Equity markets, though, continue to be in the doesn't matter camp. Small caps again rallied 1%. The S&P and the Dow Jones Industrial, after being down part of the session, managed to catch a bid and hit all-time highs on the S&P and the NASDAQ again. So it's interesting because you may have the question that I received from many clients last week. I talked to a lot of clients and some people that are coming on board with us to manage their money through either the Arrow, the Global Allocations, the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, and they all pretty much had the same question. They said to me, what's going on? Maybe some didn't use those exact words, but generally the question was, what's going on? What is it that markets are seemingly impervious and they're just in a mode that none of this information matters, whether it's geopolitical concerns, whether it's the price of oil. Like if you remember back a year ago or so, the price of oil dropping was a major impact component of markets. There was a big concern that the oil companies and the energy related companies that have a lot of earnings capacity within the overall earnings for the S&P 500, as an example, and for various indices, weren't going to help out, boost it. Therefore, the earnings growth overall is a problem. And why would people buy into energy and into the S&P itself? And, then they were going into technology and healthcare and others. But yet the energy stocks definitely pulled down the S&P. That's not happening. The S&P has like an eternal bid right now. And the question is, again, what's going on? So I think it's a pretty valid question. You probably have the same question yourself. Like, why is this levitating and seemingly just having no concern about any of these kinds of incremental news items, economic or earnings related or outlook related, whereas we are seeing the reaction in other areas that seem very appropriate. Again, bonds or gold, dollar. So there's a couple of answers here, possibly. I don't think we'll know the actual answer for a number of years into the future. It's always easier, say hindsight is 20/20. I think that's the case. It was much easier in 2004 to look back at what happened in 1999 to 2000, or, it was always easier to look back in 2010, what happened in 2007. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, that the case here is a negative one, because it's always, I could say it's always easier to look back on the election and see what happens, because before the election, it was like, oh my gosh, if this one gets in, it's going to be a disaster. If that one gets in, not going to be good. And, you know, all these murmurs about what was going to happen and prognostications from all the talking heads about what is going to play out and how it's going to play out and what's going to happen. But it wasn't until a number of months afterwards where we can explain, well, it's doing this because of this. So right when you're in the eye of it, it's kind of difficult. But here's a couple of things that I was thinking about. I guess the simplest answer and probably the most obvious, although it doesn't give you a lot of detail, it's a bull market. There's plenty of liquidity that's still making its way into the markets from the ongoing quantitative easing from Europe and the ECB, from Japan, the Bank of Japan, and in the United States through the Fed. There's a tremendous amount of easy monetary policy in the way of bond buying and quantitative easing, as well as an extremely almost depression level interest rate environment. So that's, I think, one part, right? And clearly, anytime that you see this going on, you could just say to yourself, well, it's a bull market right now. It's been a bull market for a while, and it takes a while to steer that ship in a different direction if it's going to change. It doesn't happen overnight. Sometimes you do see those one-day wonders where something will either fall or rise and it looks like everything's turning around. But generally speaking, you know, when you see that trend moving in a direction, well, it stays there for a while. One of the best ways to look at this is not, by the way, on a 10-minute or a hourly chart. What you want to do is you want to look at the daily and more appropriately weekly, and probably even better, look at the monthly chart and see what the trend is showing you there. The overriding trend on a chart, when you're trying to figure out what's going on in a big picture way, you look at the weeklies, you look at the monthlies, just to look at the longer term trend and to get yourself out of the muck of what's happening on a moment to moment basis. So the bigger trend is really what you want to be looking at when it comes to that. Now, another thing, what else is this whole answer to what's going on? Well, we have also a total lack of volatility. So many people see the stock market now, I think, as a place to just, you know, park money because there's been just no volatility. And when there's no volatility, that's seen as, well, there's no risk. And why not put my money there because everybody else is making money and I don't see a lot of downside happening here. Yeah, there's a little pocket here or there in this stock or that sector. But generally speaking, there's very little volatility. I mean, just the volatility has vanished. You got a VIX sub 10 again. Or right at 10. And with the VIX, I mean, at low levels, with volatility, general volatility, regardless of the VIX, what it's saying, with general volatility so low, I think it, you know, a lot of people that may not have invested because they see the stock market as a very aggressive and concerning place to invest where they could lose money are saying, you know what, I'm going to take the risk here. You know, I can get, for example, on some quality name stocks, some blue chips, 3-4% dividend. And let's see, what's my alternative? Oh, yeah, I can invest in a really safe place and get 2%. Well, why would you do that? So I think what's happened is that we've been conditioned over the years with the fact that markets have really not seen any substantial moves lower that have been sustained into a position and a place where we say, well, you know what? If I can get the 4%, at least I got a backstop of the dividend. And why not? The volatility is low. There's plenty of liquidity. And where else do I have the option? That's the other thing. You know, where else can I invest my money at this point to make some money on it? Even if I'm not trying to be greedy, if I'm just trying to make a reasonable rate of return. We also have a business-friendlier environment. So back to what's going on. Well, again, the potential for less regulations and a destruction of many of the onerous regulations that have come into play over the last number of years from a business standpoint are looking like they're going to be unwound. But more importantly, even if that doesn't happen, a lot of people are saying, you know what? Even if we don't get a lot of regulatory reform here, the probability is we're not going to get a lot added on. So we don't have to worry about all the different potential things that may come aboard, may happen here, really what we're talking about is just a, at least a status quo. We know what we have right now. Therefore, there's that whole thing that we always talk about of markets hate uncertainty. Well, there's not as much uncertainty anymore in terms of the regulatory environment. And that is a big thing for businesses. If businesses are able to know what's ahead of them, they can plan and do a lot more. Maybe they won't have as much concern about holding back CapEx expenditures, expansion. Maybe they won't, you know, look at this environment as one that's very business unfriendly and try to keep everything inside and not expand and do a lot more. And that will hopefully enable the stock and the company to do a lot better. Let's go one more, right? What's going on? Well, the Fed, rates are low and they act as a backstop. The Fed is acting as a backstop. We know that the Fed has been very much watching markets. Yeah, I know they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be concerned with only a few things related to the economy and general liquidity of markets. And they're, of course, the banking system. They're supposed to be really much more focused on employment and inflation. That's their two main mandates. And oh, yes, you know, them looking at markets is supposed to be a bad thing. But truth be told, they're looking at markets all the time. In fact, when they talk about raising rates and when there's mention that they don't want to do anything that really surprises markets, they're not talking about the bond markets like probably they should be because of the rate move. They're talking about the equity markets. They really believe that the wealth effect is an important component when it comes to the overall economy. The ability for markets to move higher, for people to gain confidence, therefore spend more money, and thereby increasing the GDP through the wealth effect is something they really believe is extremely not only important, but it's something that they feel is a part and parcel of what they're doing these days. So the one problem with this is that I think that the Fed, just for a moment, I got to mention this, that it's being a little bit, they're being a little bit ridiculous in a way. They're being too dovish. Let me give an example. Last week, Federal Reserve Board Harker said that the economy essentially is at normal levels. The economy is essentially at normal levels. Economic outlook is good. He sees two further rate hikes in 2017 and says unwinding of the balance sheet will be slow. Now let's take a look at that for a second here to understand what's going on with the Fed. He says the economy is basically at normal levels, yet the Fed is keeping rates, their Fed funds rates, at recessionary and I guess emergency levels, levels that you would have if things were really bad. So even though they acknowledge that the economy is running at levels that they feel has normalized already, they have not even gotten close to normalizing rates. So that is a big issue, because they're increasing the ability to have an incredible amount of liquidity in the markets, and keeping rates low enhances the ability to borrow money to do all sorts of things, which, by the way, includes not only things like buying a house or getting a loan for a business or refinancing or even issuing debt to then do buybacks of your stock, but it also increases the opportunity to get margin and leverage on your equity investments at a low cost. Now, if the Fed goes ahead and says, oh, well, things are going well and we're going to stick by that whole, you know, outlook that we have and the plan that we have to raise rates at least twice during the year, what are they going to raise to? They're going to rate 1.5%? It's still at ridiculously low levels for this economic environment. Think about it. Think about where we are. 4.3% unemployment rate. The lowest in 16 years. If you go back and you look at what the rate was 16 years ago, go ahead, do it. Do the math. It was not 1%. It wasn't even close. And if you look at what a normal level should be, let's say maybe, let's just throw this out there, right? Let's just say we agree that, all right, 4% is a normalized rate for an economy that has a 4 to 4.5% unemployment rate, where economic activity through manufacturing and the services are doing fine. We're at 1% or so right now, going up to about 1.5%. That's if they can somehow find their way to do so. They also mentioned they're going to be unwinding of the balance sheet, but it will be slow. Slow could take a decade, maybe longer. They have over $4 trillion of debt on their balance sheet that they have acquired through this quantitative easing program, money printing, whatever you want to call it. $4 trillion, but they're going to go slow in its unwind. So now, if you want to know what's going on here for a second, well, the Fed is thinking, yeah, we can raise interest rates, which they haven't been able to do. And just look, by the way, over at what's going on in Europe and Japan, the whole idea of raising inflation rates, not working. They're acknowledging that the economic activity here is operating at normal levels, but they can't raise rates that are consistent with the economic conditions. They're a bunch of lunatics because, you know, what they're doing is actually, I dare say, fueling the next bubble, which is clearly in government-issued debt, Fed-related processes that have been increasing the amount of debt that is held on the balance sheets that they're going to unwind over years that have to take years because they're the incremental buyer. I think right now, Bank of Japan owns 2/3 of the Japanese government bonds that are even out there. That's how much quantitative easing has been done over the past 10 years. They've actually tripled the amount of bonds they owned over the last, I guess it was about 4 years. And they can't get inflation going. We're not going to get inflation going either under this plan. I don't see it. I don't see it at all. Speaking about inflation, by the way, I did a quick a Twitter poll. You can find me at Andrew Horowitz, as I mentioned, and the results are interesting. We didn't have we had a good number of people voting, but here's the question I asked. I said, in your life, are you experiencing inflation at any level at all? And 57% of the participants said yes across all expenses, 34% somewhat, but not too much. 9% said not at all, and nobody said deflation. So I'm not sure how they're going to expect inflation to increase with their low interest rates, in that on paper it should work, but it hasn't worked in reality. And there's other things at play here. There's a lot more things going on that they are obviously not able to combat. So when you think about what all the things that are going on and how things are playing out, well, you have all those going on. You have liquidity in the markets. You have low volatility. You have really no alternative where to invest at this point. You have a bull market trend that's going on. You have really a lack of any concern about the data. Think it's transitory. You have the idea, the hope that there's going to be some regulatory reform and businesses have much more clarity and confidence that they can operate without any of these crazy additions to their overhead and in terms of their regulations. So a lot of that's going to play. And then, of course, the Fed having low interest rates and keeping a backstop, an implied and a real backstop to markets, as they have been, you know, very concerned with this. So, you know, by the way, with the Fed, even though they talk about being at a slow pace and even though they talk about how they're going to have 2 rate hikes during the next several months, possibly the next one coming up at the June meeting, and fiscal policy appearing to be taking much longer than expected, 2 things are happening. First, bonds. I mean, yields are at sub 220. That's pretty amazing if you think about it. Yields are below 2.2% when the Fed has been telegraphing that they're going to increase rates. And what has been happening with that? Well, yeah, if you haven't been watching this, the financials have been under some pretty severe pressure recently. As a matter of fact, they had a really good run after the election and then turned around pretty dramatically after the election into 2017. The yield curve has been flattening, and actually the rates have been coming down. The hope was that they were going to see an expansion and a significant move on the long end, and the short end would come in or at least come up a little bit, but that spread would be able to help them on their margins. And that hasn't really been playing out that well. So financials have been under some interesting pressure. And the question, I wondered, I said, you know, is this a good time to buy? So I took a look at the chart. I want to do a quick breakdown of the financial ETF chart, XLF. Now, it's down about 7% over the last 3 months. Still up this year about 1% through Friday, through the beginning of June. Now, on a daily price chart, what I noticed was that there was a consolidation since the end of March. Kind of a move up, down. A consolidation is a price move through a range that's pretty confined. No breakouts to the downside that's significant. No breakups on the upside. So right now, a couple of other things that were noticeable to me, that if you look at the chart on XLF, you'll see that the current price is right below the 50-day moving average, and it's also below the 200-day daily moving average. And the 200-day moving average, is the slope of it is slightly up, but pretty much starting to become horizontal. It's not really sloping any higher, but the 50-day moving average is actually sloping down, and it has been sloping down since mid-April. There's a pretty solid level of support that has now become resistance. When you're above a level that is a line in the sand that we call it support, when you're below it, it's called resistance. And right now, this line in the sand has become resistance. Now, we have an indicator we call Aileron. We created this especially for TradeStation users. It's a plugin for TradeStation where it's a combination of an oscillator and a momentum indicator. It has about 14 different components that look at overbought, oversold, and trend lines. It does a really good job at finding these levels that are oversold in an area that you can use it to confirm other support levels and potentially for bounce buys or for exits or for short executions. Now, recently, it's looking like it's in an overall downtrend for XLF. And that downtrend recently peaked, I guess, about May 19th. Now, we're starting to see a slight momentum shift on that indicator where we're seeing that downtrend that peaked on May 19th is starting to turn. In other words, when you get so oversold, we get an indication. I'll put this chart on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes for episode 512. But if you're looking at this and you're seeing what's going on here, you'll notice that there are some of these yellow stars, clusters we call them, where it's a extreme level of either oversold or overbought. The yellow ones that we're looking at, there was two in April and one in May. Those are usually times when there is a level of selling that goes on that is so to a point of getting exhaustion, where if you do see that starting to turn to the upside, well, it may be a good buy point at that point. So you buy on the exhaustion drop. Now, we saw this a couple of times, and usually you'd look at this and say, okay, well, now we're seeing less negative levels than we saw in April, and now we're into May, and it's starting to turn up again, and it could be a time to buy. But we also saw a similar situation in mid-April that went up, and it did, in fact, start to move higher, but then it reversed right down. It failed. So here's my feeling on the XLF. Until there is a nice and a very significant hold above the support level, and we see that the momentum shifts in a way that is significant, so we have to get and hold above, let's say 2350 to 2370, somewhere around there. And until we see that and we see the momentum changing, especially with the 10-year sub 220, 225, this is kind of an area that you want to just kind of watch to see how this is going to play out. If in fact, for whatever reason, the Fed doesn't raise rates or rates continue to stay low, it's not good for the banks and the financials. Just not. So I think you have to watch that and just wait to see what happens here. I just don't find this to be something that is like, oh, I got to run out and buy this right away. Now, with that in mind, okay, you do realize that anytime something hits a level of oversold or exhaustion these days, there is a mighty wave of buying that goes in. It's uncanny. And that's probably the last part of why these markets are continuing to stay buoyant. You know, that question I start off with what's going on? FOMO. Fear of missing out. This is something that was coined on the whole social media side of things where, you know, people were just, you know, oh, I got to do this because everybody's seeing pictures of all these people enjoying and, you know, doing things, whether it's at the beach or eating or with their families or, you know, they take the best pictures of all the great things that are happening and jealousy. By the way, FOMO is a combination, I think, of jealousy and anxiety. Oh, I should be doing that. They're doing so great. I got to do it too. And then you get anxious and you got to go ahead and do something. And in the markets, people are seeing that all-time new highs splashed across all sorts of media. Oh, the S&P hit an all-time high. And you get this fear of missing out. So anytime there's a drop, even a 1% drop on markets, buyers are FOMOing. They're saying, I got to buy. I got to get in. It's my chance. I waited this long. I better get in. Or they're thinking, well, this isn't going to last. And if I don't get in now, when will I have a shot at this level again? There was a gentleman on TV a couple of weeks back when the markets were down 1.75% saying this was a buy of a lifetime. The buy of a lifetime. A 1.5 or 1.7% drop on markets in one day was the buy of a lifetime. Now, to me, a buy of a lifetime would be, let's just say, markets dropped 25% in a day and stocks were obliterated. That could be the buy of a lifetime, potentially. It could be the start of something much worse, but, you know, it could be the buy of a lifetime. A stock dropping, 90% because of, I don't know why, some bad information that came out and maybe a good stock that just something weird happened. That could be the buy of a lifetime. But a 1.75% drop on markets? I don't know if that's a buy of a lifetime. It just doesn't seem that way to me. But I guess that's how you get on TV. You say these crazy things. Let me do a real quick recap, by the way, on some of the things that are going on and what's happening this year. I was just looking at some of the sectors. Now, the S&P's, 500 in this, as far as the SPY is concerned, the SPY, year-to-date's up, about 9%? The industrial's up 9%. The consumer cyclical is up 10%. So all the ones above now, the S&P, what particular sectors of the S&P are actually outpacing the S&P, pulling it all the way up? So we're talking about the consumer staples, utilities up 11.5%, healthcare up 12%, home builders up 13%, consumer discretionary up 13%, and tech up a whopping 18%. And these are based on the ETFs that represent each of these sectors. Now, below the line, materials up 8%, still impressive. Telecom up 6%, financials up less than 1%, and energy down 13%. Actually, energy's down 13%. Kind of interesting and I think very revealing that we are seeing this spread between technology, consumer discretionary, and energy. Consumer discretionary is interesting also because it is such, there's been so much going on in that sector, particularly the retail side of it, whereas many of the major players like the large department stores, or as we call them, the big box stores, are getting obliterated. Some of the smaller names, teen retailer and apparel, not doing so well. Amazon just off the charts. But consumer discretionary has been holding up really well. And you would expect that to be the case where we have a good employment situation. So that's kind of, I think, right in line and expected. Let's see what else. Oh, I had one other thing I wanted to mention. And there's a good piece by our friends over at TIS. This was, let me just read what, there was a couple of things I wanted to, I can never pronounce his name. Larry Jabola, Jabodoria, Jabdadila, I can't pronounce his name. Jabdula. He writes a piece for the TIS group, and he's been on our show a few different times. He had some really interesting ideas on what's going on with the China debt and what's happening there. I took this chart I was looking at. I was really shocked the way it was presented, at least in terms of how much debt China has really issued over the last 10 years. The government has been continuing to allow for a massive property bubble to grow. And the big question is, you know, who's affected by this the most? And the amount of debt that's out there and the balance sheets and the derivatives again and all that went on back when. It's fascinating that JP Morgan, Citibank, Goldman, and Bank of America have notional amount of derivative valuations on their books in the trillions of dollars. And he was going on to say, you know, when would this bubble pop in terms of some of the real estate in China, maybe even in Canada, what's going on there and other areas around the world where real estate has been just going bananas again. Already we're seeing in London things coming back and softening up. But he was talking about 2021 as a target where things just, if it continues at these levels and doesn't get constrained at all, that we may have another real estate crisis on our hand, not here in the United States necessarily, but affecting our banks because of their exposure to many of the areas around the world. So something of interest there. Anyway, we're going to end it there. No. I take it back. I forgot. We have some listener questions that I wanted to get to. By the way, you can ask any questions that you want. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And you can go to the Ask Andrew section, a little button on the top that says Ask Andrew, and just ask the question. So you can just do so. Let's see. Usually I'll do my best to either answer them. By the way, on the upcoming episode, we got a lot that came in. We'll answer a few of them in this episode. Or I'll answer you directly in email. Maybe it's a little bit more personal. So we have a question from Brian, and he says, I'm a new investor, and your show was suggested from various articles I came across that reviewed investment podcasts. I am using the Robinhood application to purchase stocks, and I'm holding stocks for at least 1 year. Any advice on the financials that a new investor should focus on or find a company that is undervalued? And he also asked the question, which we just answered, by the way, on why financial banks are getting hammered lately. He says, thanks, and keep up the great work. All right, Brian. So I think that to answer your question about what you should be looking for, what we like to look for is consistency of growth of earnings and growth of revenue, sales. We also like to look at things like, well, what's the ROE? Over 17 is a number that's kind of a level that we look at, return on equity. I also look at things like margin expansion, growth of margin. Are companies able to have better, you know, as we're seeing their earnings grow and as we're seeing their revenues grow, are we also seeing their margins expand? That's a good way to see kind of internally what's happening. There's gross margins and net margins. But even so, you look at either one, look at the net margins especially, well, what's happening? Are they able to make more money on the money that's coming in, even if their revenues are slowing? Now, this doesn't give you companies necessarily that are over or undervalued. We don't really look at that whole valuation thing as undervalued or overvalued, but we want to see growth and consistency of growth and ongoing growth and ability to maintain that growth. Now, if you're looking for things that are undervalued, now you have to do something totally different here, which, again, we don't use as much. And you have to look at things like book value, price to book, price to sales, PE ratio, PEG ratio, things like that. So if you want to look at those, you can look at valuation and what maybe is undervalued or overvalued for that matter. Or you can look at what we like to look at is a growth orientation for equities. This question comes in from Michael T. And he says, hi, Andrew, question for you. My wife and I have an emergency fund of $5,000. About a year ago, I had the brilliant idea to invest in two mutual funds and try to grow the money even bigger. Well, long story short, the funds that I picked, one was a biotech pharmaceutical fund, have gone down about 20% since then. Some suggest that an emergency fund shouldn't be invested because, just like I experienced, you could run into a downturn that affects the amount of your emergency fund. That's correct. The same person suggested putting the money into a money market account because it's no risk, keeps the funds liquid, and you can get some small returns. I went out today to investigate the money market rates and found that banks and credit unions are only offering about 0.25 to 1%. That's barely enough to keep up with inflation. If you had $5,000 saved for an emergency fund, what would you do with it? Well, Michael, the guy that you talked to, the gal that you talked to is exactly right. An emergency fund is targeted for emergencies. And the last thing that you want to happen with an emergency fund, which sometimes is quoted at 3 to 6 months of salary, because if something happens to you and you can't work, and maybe you have disability insurance, maybe, but if something happens to you and you can't work, you need somewhere to tap very quickly. You need some savings that is just sitting there ready to go. And an emergency fund that covers 3 to 6 months of your salary, of your income, should be placed in a place that has no volatility, that is boring. It's money that's set aside that you don't even touch, you don't even look at, you don't even deal with. And if you get the idea and the itch one day to invest it, you don't do it because it's an emergency fund. And right now, to get back your 20%, you have to make like 30% return to get back to square one. And that's not how that works. Let's see here. Next question we have from Nick M. He says, Dear Andrew, I'm a big fan of the podcast and very grateful for the discussions and interviews that you are conducting. Quite a significant contribution to the financial education of your listeners. Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. I have a couple of questions regarding long-term investments for retirement. I'm 25, have started ETF layaway plan a couple of years ago. I have this implemented as my disciplined way of ensuring to invest in a diversified set of assets for the long-term horizon as a retirement booster in 40 years' time or so. I am now struggling with current portfolio situation. While most indices are close to all-time highs, I start to wonder whether it would make more sense to take some off the gains off the sidelines and proceed the proceeds to the next dip. Or does that mean that I have to say disciplined, regular rebalancing based on recent performance and portfolio structure? Here's the problem, Nick. So what you first said to me was that you're working on a disciplined process of investing in ETFs on a diversified approach for some time, about 40 years from now. And then you go into the conversation that you want to be a market timer, that all of a sudden you think that, maybe now's the time. Whereas if you are going with along this plan that you laid out here, which I have no objection to, right? Different strokes for different folks, how you want to invest and how you want to work with your money. If you are going to be working on a long-term investment for retirement, and you're working on a dollar cost averaging plan to put money away on a regular basis that is going to be used sometime in the very far future, what you want to do probably is more of a rebalancing process from the big gains into some of the losers, okay, just to get yourself rebalanced according to an appropriate allocated investment portfolio that is diversified in a way that is consistent with your level of risk. If you're thinking about taking out now, you're talking about market timing. And that's a very difficult task because then I'll ask you, what's the plan to get back in? It's not so easy. There are ways to do that and there are ways to structure that, but this doesn't seem like that kind of portfolio. And that doesn't seem like what you're looking to accomplish. If you want to do that, put some money in a different account and use that as your market timing portfolio, but don't screw with your diversified ETF rebalancing portfolio that's built on the idea of diversification for the long haul. I hope that makes sense. That's, by the way, the differences between the disciplined investor managed growth strategy that we invest in for clients and, let's say, the global allocations or the investology portfolios, which is also different than Arrow, which is a true market timing process. Let's see here. This question came in from Charlie. He says, I'm an avid listener of the Disciplined Investor and DH Unplugged podcast. Two very unbiased, thought-provoking financial podcasts offering a focus on long-term investments versus short-term trading. Thank you, sir. Two questions below that I have been pondering as I continue to hear people encouraging passive ETFs for people at my age, about 25. The adage, if something's too good to be true, it probably is. And the rise of non-dividend paying, debt-ridden tech stocks has me totally befuddled. He says, first up, with the talk about passive money and ETF driving valuations in stocks higher, is there any way to derive the percent of a stock that is owned by ETFs? Along with the same lines, how are ETFs considered in the float of the stock? Is there any way to arrive at the true float of a stock while delineating stock ownership over international ownership, institutional ownership, ETF ownership, and insider ownership? That's a good question. I mean, you'd need some, there are some places, yes, Charlie, there are some places that you could find how much of the stock is owned. First of all, you can look at institutional ownership. A lot of places show that. I think even Yahoo Finance or Google Finance shows institutional ownership. So that will give you how much of institutions, whether it's hedge funds or ETFs or, you know, all that owns that. There are other places you can look. I think Morningstar and a few others, there's some freebies out there you could find this. But I think Yahoo Finance maybe has some of this as well. So I would look there. I don't know if you could really start picking apart the actual true float of the stock and try to move to find out what the real retail float is versus institutionals, unless you have something like a Bloomberg or a Reuters or something like that. There's another question. He says, is there any aggregated website or API I can turn to see how the portfolio composition of an ETF has changed over time? Well, you could look at, there are websites. There are some, yes, like a Y charts that we use on for some things. There is Morningstar. You could probably, some of the APIs are expensive though. You may want to do it anyway. But you could also look at the annual reports and see what's happened there and what they've owned from over time. I'm not sure what you're trying to get to here, but if you're looking at trying to find style drift in a mutual fund, that may be something you want to look at. But I don't know if ETFs really matter because it's just the components of an index for the most part on the passive side. So, all right, we have a few more, but we'll get to that in the next episode from Rob, from Nick, Jay, Ken. I got a few more here. We'll get to that in the next show. Anyway, thanks for listening. Again, sorry this was late this week. A little technical difficulties getting this up and done. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz, of course, you could check out all there is to know about what's going on with the strategies that we manage for our clients with the Arrow, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, the Global Allocations, upcoming Investology. Just go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. One more thing. Please do me a favor. Tell some friends. Just listen in and click the button, send to a friend in Messenger, an email, tweet it, do something. Spread the word, spread the news on what we're doing here. Hopefully it's helping you and helped you over the years. And if so, it has, do us a favor and make sure to tell others about that. And of course, listen each and every week on Tuesday nights to DH Unplugged, myself and John C. Dvorak talk about markets and some of the crazier side of business. Anyway, until next week, I'll see you. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.